Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds.
And the anti-trans Missouri AG can now access trans people's medical records. We have such an interesting show for you today. Serial's co-hosts Sarah Koenig and Dana Shivas join us to talk about their newest season on Guantanamo Bay. Then we'll talk to Chief Medical Officer for Planned Parenthood Arizona, Dr. Jill Gibson, about women's reproductive health in the state of Arizona. But first we have the host of The Enemies List, the one, the only, Rick Wilson.
Welcome back, my friend, Monday special with the Rick Wilson.
Happy Monday to everyone, and happy Donald Trump squirming like a miserable worm in court all day to those who celebrate.
So let's talk about this week. The thing I'm so incredibly irritated with is the people are like, well, this is the least good case. You know, it's a state case that goes up to a federal case, right? The idea is that when you pay off the adult film star that you're having an affair with after your third wife has delivered your fifth child, if you do that in the hopes of keeping it from coming out right before in a presidential election, that's technically a campaign finance violation, which, I mean, the problem is it's just like the idea of like Trump having to technically follow the law like the rest of us is kind of like not how we do it.
It irritates him greatly.
But also like the whole country has been set up to like let Trump do what Trump does.
You know, that's one of the things that we keep undercounting, I think, in our politics right now, is that we hear this all the time talking to reporters. Like, I'll call a reporter and say, you know, this thing is da 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 da. And it's like, oh, yeah, everybody knows. Oh, yeah,
right,
everybody knows
right.
that. It's fine.
Baked in.
That's what he is. It's just Trump being Trump. And they have wired it so far in to their discount rate of Trump that the horror of these things, which should horrify people, people should be like, oh, shit, not, weird.
Yeah.
They should be shocked about these things. They just don't seem to have a reaction to them that is merited by the extremity of the criminality that he engages in all the time.
Yeah. It's almost as if like this sort of DC intelligentsia has overthunk Trump. I mean, part of it is that none of us are over 2016.
Right.
And so, you know, in 2016, we all thought we knew. And I mean, talk about that.
So 2016, I think there were three mental breakpoints. This is not a particularly novel thought. The first was, Trump can never win the general, never can win the primary. A true conservative like Jeb Bush or Ted Cruz, the Republicans would never accept a profligate, morally bankrupt, lifetime philanderer, adulterer, scumbag, weirdo, former Democrat, Hillary donor.
You feel like he's listening, right? I feel like when you go on these tangents, it's because you know someone from the RNC is listening to this and you just want them to hear every
poke,
yes.
Poke, 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 poke.
Anyway, yeah, go on.
No, but we thought that, you know, initially in 16, everyone thought that Trump's absurdity and lack of conservative credential would disqualify him. Okay, cool. Then they thought all the things people were discovering about Trump and that Trump was doing and saying, John McCain wasn't a war hero, suckers and all the, you know, pile it up. And then everyone's like, that disqualifies him. And then, and this was on the media and on the Democratic side, why no one could ever defeat the great Hillary Clinton, the best candidate ever. Okay.
You're so naughty. Because it's like, yeah, all right. She was not a good, yeah.
She's not a good candidate. Set aside her other merits and virtues. I think even she would tell you she's not a natural at the politicking part.
Part of it is that. Part of it is that America just is not ready to have a woman president, at least.
Well, and part of it was that Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch had spent 30 years turning her into the demonic queen of hell and blah, blah, blah.
Right. A really good point she had. And that really did work.
It worked at scale. So what I'm saying is the misapprehensions of 2016 led reporters to say, okay, well, you know what? Everybody knows that about Trump. Everybody gets it about Trump. But people didn't. They did not get it. They did not know it. These were things that they still haven't internalized, and that today the Republicans work the refs better than anything else. They work the refs. They worked them for years now, and they're desperately afraid to not platform and to not salute and to not treat the phrase out of Trump's mouth as if they are uttered by a normal, sane candidate. Now, I think we all know by now that Donnie is not normal. He is not sane. He is not a candidate or a man who plays by the rules that the press seems to think he's playing by. He doesn't play by any rules. And that for his people, they love that. But for reporters and for political establishment types and for everyone else, they think, okay, well, someday he'll be under control. Why, a second term can't possibly be as crazy as the first.
Yeah, that was...
But they keep platforming the guy in a way that doesn't treat the madness in as front and center a way as it legitimately deserves to be treated. So what we're going to do again is act like these cases are just, you know, baked in the cake,
right,
that they're normal, that the things that Trump gets away with, he gets a special dispensation for. And honestly, right now, people in the media that are, you know, people you and I both know, they struggle with it. And yet at the end of the day, they still write the same attenuated, deferential stories. And look, I have seen some improvement lately. MSN and CNN both this week, you know, went at Trump's lying really well, like leading out, like Trump lied today about his position on abortion. His lie about this is a false statement by Trump, but there's still too much of quoting the madness as a fact. Trump today reported that Biden was conspiring against him in the courts, and the courts are run by Joe Biden. They still don't frame it legitimately as journalists and say, this colossal lie by a criminal who is lying. No criminal has ever not been in court willing to say, oh, no, I'm being framed by the bad people. And that's what Trump's doing. And there's a degree to which he's getting away with it.
The problem with pundit world, the pundit industrial complex of which we are ones, is
we are part of,
is that there's like a feeling that you have to be right and you have to know. So when you approach this case, you say, well, it's not as strong a case as the documents case, which is there's not much to prove, right? He took the documents, he kept the documents, they asked for the documents back. He said, no, thank you. I'm not going to give them back. But, you know, you have a Trumpy judge. And like, this is the thing about, you know, we talk so much about like the guardrails, and these guardrails were really set up for politicians who were willing to sort of say, oh, this mm-hmm. is enough, you know, who were able to self-regulate, which Trump cannot.
My favorite cope right now that I'm watching come out of like the National Review guys, like Dan McLaughlin and Rich Lowry. It's like, the guardrails and institutions of America will keep Trump bounded. He's certainly not going to violate the sacred constitutional order of America.
Right.
I'm like, the fuck are you talking about? Who the fuck are you talking about? You're talking about Donald J. Trump. And anyone who tells you, folks, here's a really simple test. Anybody who says to you, America's institutions are so resilient that Trump would never even dream of violating them.
Right.
Have you been asleep or in a coma or drunk for the last 8 years? He is always going to do what he tells you he will do. He's going to violate the law, the Constitution.
He's going to be a dictator on day one.
He's going to be a dictator. And by the way, I've defied people. Like, give me an example of someone who was a dictator for only a day. The allure of power is too strong.
Well, also, first of all, I'm going to be a dictator on day one and get us drilling, okay? We're the largest exporter. We don't need to drill anymore. In fact, we drill so much, you know? And then, but also it's bullshit. Of course he's going to be a dictator on day one and day two and day three. I mean, there is no, what I'm like irritated by is that everyone's like, well, we got to give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt. No, we don't.
No benefit of the doubt is required for Donald Trump. We know what he is. He is telling us what he will do. And the idea that anyone at this point in our history, in this country, has a doubt about what this will look like, and anyone who's giving you excuses like, he's learned his lesson. You know, this is Hitler tamed by prison, New York Times headline, 1936. It doesn't work that way with this guy. And I know people are like, how dare you compare Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler?
He hasn't started a camp yet.
He hasn't actually put anybody in a boxcar to a death camp yet.
But it is like very annoying to me too that like we don't ever talk about that Donald Trump decided to declare his presidential run because he was hoping it would prevent him from being indicted.
Yeah, he didn't want to go to prison. He doesn't want to be indicted. We really now have seen what $100 million will do to throw sand in the gears of the, oh, of our resilient laws and institutions, right? And systems. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
And imagine when he's president again, what happens to all of those cases that are out there? You know what happens? They go away. We're lucky Merrick Garland hasn't pulled the plug on all the federal cases already.
I'm reading this book, America First. You know about this book?
Yes, I have it.
The History of the Right.
Yeah.
I know you'll be shocked to hear this, but a lot of this stuff, you know, like there were periods before World War II where the right was pretty aligned with Hitler and said things like, you know, the America First movement, the name America First, came from a group that supported this isolationist wing and Charles Lindbergh.
Look, the German-American Bund was an incredibly broad and powerful political force that was growing in influence in this country. They were outright seditionists. And before that, it was Friends of the New German Order or something like that. These were people, by the way, tell me if this rings a bell, who were right-leaning Americans who were deeply enamored with a strange model of an authoritarian in an overseas nation. And today, those same people are the America Firsters. Look, you've got J.D. Vance writing in the pages of the New York Times, like, dear Mr. Putin, may I come and give you a foot massage? And by the way, I know the Times has had plenty of moments where it has questioned whether it should be platforming certain people. And you know what? If they want to platform J.D. Vance, that's fine. But they should have people who are putting forth actual true statements as opposed to what J.D. Vance did in the Times this week, which was to lie repeatedly about Ukraine and about the American role in Ukraine, and to lie repeatedly about the consequences of giving up and allowing Vladimir Putin to roll up in the streets of Europe.
Yeah. With the New York Times, I would just say, and I know everyone's going to get mad at me for saying this, but, you know, they are the biggest newspaper. They set the tone for a lot of the conversations we have. Mm-hmm. And so they sometimes people get mad at them, and they're a big enough, strong enough institution where they should be able to handle that.
you know, they should have. And unfortunately, I think that they have not learned their lesson about when you platform a Tom Cotton or you platform a J.D. Vance at this moment in our history, they're not honest brokers. They are people who are defending an emergent global fascist movement in our century and not in the 1930s. And there were plenty of people in the 1930s who were willing to defend Hitler in America. There were plenty of people in this moment who are willing to defend Vladimir Putin and any other authoritarian that comes down the block.
But the right's love of authoritarianism has been around for a long time. That's what I'm saying. It's not
new. Oh, yeah. And over the weekend, you had this like moment of utter confusion among a lot of people on the far right who are like, okay, wait, so Russia is Iran's ally, but Iran is attacking Israel, right. But we don't really like the Jews that much, but we don't like the Iranians, but we love the Russians.
Yeah,
and
oops.
You could hear like the gears in their heads going click, 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 and the machine blowing
up. Yeah, it's very hard for them. You know, I mean, it's a very simplistic view on the world.
It is a sad view, I think, in a lot of ways in the world. It is a view that diminishes the sacrifices of Americans over the last 80 years since World War II, when we fought the long war against the Nazis and against German and authoritarianism, and then we fought the long war against Soviet communism. And now we've sort of unwound that with this amazing emergence of affection and love for a new strain of authoritarianism in the world. It's bad right now, but if Trump is returned to power by some misfortune, it will be utterly catastrophic because, as we've seen the reporting in the last few days, Trump's quote unquote great plan to end the war in Ukraine is to give Russia Ukraine.
Yes, that is true. But that's
to cut them off and to give them Ukraine.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's going to work out great for everybody except, you know, Ukraine.
Well,
and Europe and NATO.
And Poland. I mean, I think Poland would like a word, you know.
Yeah.
To watch American conservatives' love affair with Putin and Erdogan continue, this is not so different than they were with Hitler. So the point is, now we wait.
And by the way, MAGAs, if you're listening and you're not happy with what we're saying about comparing Trump and Putin to Hitler, then they should be less like Hitler.
Right.
Then they should be less affectionate towards Hitler.
I think that Putin certainly does kill all his enemies. Trump, it's a little bit different.
For now.
Right. Well, and also this authoritarian style of leadership is not how we do it in this country.
Well, it's not how we have done it in this country. If we reelect Donald Trump, that is how we do it. That is how we will be doing it in this country. If we reelect Donald Trump, that is what will happen in this country. They will engage in the use of authoritarian power because they've justified it in their minds by saying, well, we're in a generational civilizational battle. And unless we win now by whatever means necessary, then the white race will die out.
Right. Well, and that's what this is. It's the last gasp of racism and this sort of death knell of...
I don't know, Molly. I wouldn't say it's the last gasp. You know why?
Why?
I think they're breathing pretty easily. I think they've got a pretty comfortable feeling right now that they have managed to mainstream a lot of things that 25 years ago we would have said... 25 years ago, conservative Republicans would have said, get the F out of here. You're too racist.
Well, the right has moved to the right, but the left has moved to the center, at least for now. Rick Wilson, thank you.
You are very welcome. And I will talk to you again next time.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50. And it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Spring is here, and I bet you are trying to look fashionable. So why not pick up some fashionable, all-new Fast Politics merchandise? We just opened a new store with all new designs just for you. Get t-shirts, hoodies, hats, and tote bags. To grab some, head to fastpolitics.com. Sarah Koenig and Dana Shivas are the co-hosts of Serial. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello, thank you.
And welcome, Dana.
Hi, thanks for having us.
I feel like it's the most famous podcast in the world, but I guess it's probably not, right? Or is it?
I mean, you're asking the wrong people, obviously. No, I mean, I don't know.
It's not Joe Rogan. You know that, right?
Right. Okay, you're right. All right. That's a good point. Joe Rogan.
This is Serial.
It's important. Yes. Oh, this is Serial. I'm introducing you guys. We are going to talk about this incredible podcast that really did start. I mean, there have been movies made of it, but it is true. All of us are much poorer and less famous than Joe Rogan. I think that's important to take a moment to, though he did eat a bug on television and he was the host of Fear Factor, ergo I take all my health advice from him. So talk to me about what this season of Serial looks like.
This season of Serial, we devoted the whole podcast to stories about Guantanamo. And each episode is a different story that has taken place over the course of Guantanamo's 22-year history. But the thing we were trying to do was actually go to the individual stories. So stories of people on the ground at Guantanamo who have sort of been put through that very weird system there and spat out the other side for the most part. And so sort of look at Guantanamo through the lens of the individuals on the ground who have actually had to deal with the place as part of their lives. So that includes plenty of Americans, personnel, interrogators, guards, commanders, lawyers, but also a bunch of former detainees as well.
It's 9 episodes. We hope we're still working. And it's like a weird personal history. We wanted to call it people's history in the first episode, but then I got embarrassed. I thought people would think we were ripping off Howard Zinn.
Because we were.
By the way, in case you're wondering, nobody's thinking that. Like, you know, you're like in the sort of intelligentsia when that's your anxiety.
So that's kind of what it is. It's kind of a human scale, I don't know, a small scale history, personal history of what this place has been like for people who have experienced it either from the working there side or running it and also locked up there.
Is the theory here that it says a lot about America, this site?
Yes, of course it does. Of course it does. I know it's hard to start talking about what Guantanamo means, and then it starts to get very ponderous and kind of sad. But, you know, if you're asking, yeah. I was talking to a sort of colleague in the audio world recently, and he put it so nicely, and I was like, oh, I'm going to steal that, which was, I don't know, he was just saying, like, we have actually a really high tolerance for abandoning our ideals and our values in America, and we sort of hide that most of the time. But Guantanamo, he was like, it seems like Guantanamo is this place where we stored all of that. It was like, it's like a repository for our tolerance for aberration in our criminal justice system or in the way that we prosecute war and crime.
I think about, you know, I lived in New York during 9/11. And so I feel like that was the sort of excuse we used to sort of betray all of these American values. It was such a long time ago. It is burned into my brain. Like my experiences during 9/11, like the people that I knew who died, the like seeing the plane fly into the towers, like it is for years when I would hear ambulances, I would think like, oh, they've got, it's another one. Like, you know, because the sounds, the smells, like it did birth this shadow world, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, you know, that's been interesting in reporting it is just having to really contemplate the different points of view, some of which you know, I as a reporter and maybe Dana too, like we don't agree with. And so you can kind of walk through life for a long time being like, well, that's bullshit. But you talk to these people and they really are like, my job was to protect the American people. We didn't know what was coming next. And like you're saying, like you sort of have this you're bracing for the next attack kind of, or the next crisis at that time. And that was, it's easy to forget that was real, that feeling and that fear. And that there were a bunch of people whose job it was to like run it down and make sure it doesn't happen again. That is an impossible job. And so they were trying to do it. And I don't excuse, you know, some of the terrible things that happened, but you have a greater understanding, I think, for that pressure and what that pressure felt like for people.
Yeah. When we are talking about it, I mean, we were all in an impossible situation, but it ended up being made so much worse. What is the status of Gitmo right now? And what is, because I know there, I mean, and what about this sort of like interesting legal kind of nuance of where these people went and what happened to them? Give me sort of some of the sort of interesting through lines.
Molly, you were bringing up like 9/11 was so long ago. And in one sense, it was like in doing this podcast, one of the things we debated a lot is like, how much of this era do we have to explain? Like, do we have to explain to people who the Taliban are? What's the difference between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda? And then in another sense, like it wasn't actually that long ago. And I think a lot of people have sort of relegated Guantanamo to history. But the fact of the matter is there are still 30 men locked up at Guantanamo today.
Jesus.
The prison is still open.
It's a quarter of a century later and they're still there.
Yes, exactly. Not all at one time, but 780 prisoners have been held there over time. So it's obviously vastly reduced from the population that it used to be. But just to say, like, it's not a thing that is relegated to history yet because it's actually still like right there. Like, yeah, theoretically, you could go to the prison right now and visit it.
Yeah.
for a lot of the prisoners who have been released, I mean, they really struggle because they were at Guantanamo, and what people know Guantanamo to be is a prison for terrorists, right? Like, that's sort of how we all sort of shorthand the place. And so it's really hard to be released from a place like that and try to go back into society and restart your life when you're coming with the sort of like taint of a place like that. A lot of them really, really struggle having left.
But also, there were no rules, right? Some people were sent there for one reason, some were sent there for another. It wasn't, you know, there was a certain like sort of constitutional pause, right? That you could be sent there if you were, I mean, they weren't even all American citizens, right?
Yeah, I mean, they weren't not American citizens. And basically, Guantanamo originally was meant to be, for all intents and purposes, basically a prisoner of war camp. But the Bush administration did not want to have to follow certain rules, Geneva Conventions, namely. And so did a workaround, basically. They worked around that by not ever calling it a prisoner of war camp, not ever calling the prisoners prisoners of war. They were unlawful enemy combatants, which their lawyers interpreted to mean they could treat them than we sort of would normally, quote unquote, normally. That's really like the point at which everything kind of went awry and started to go awry. And it's just, you know, it's lasted now for 22 years. And so from that sort of original aberration, now you have like just this sort of like aberrations in all the other normal systems that should have followed, and most expressly the justice system that they built there, which is sort of looks like a justice system, but does not act like a normal justice system.
So what does it look like?
So Guantanamo is, it's a bunch of things, but principally it's two things. There's this, what we casually call a prison. They don't call it a prison. They call it a detention facility. But so there's this prison that operates kind of like a prison you would recognize in the United States at this point. It didn't in the beginning, but now it does. And then there's a court. There's a special court there that is functioning incredibly slowly in some cases. But the case that most people have heard about, if they've heard about any of them, is the case against the men accused of planning 9/11, the 9/11 attacks. And that case has been, there have been various versions of this court that get stood up and then declared not okay, and then they get revised and stood up again. The current court that's functioning, I think, has been going since 2012. And so that case of the 9/11 defendants, I mean, and other cases as well, but that's sort of the one that most people are aware of, has been in pretrial more than 10 years, 12 years, something like that. And it is nowhere near going to trial. And it could get settled by a plea agreement, and that is maybe the more likely thing that would happen. That's been up in the air now for a while. But the core issue there, and this is across a couple of the other cases as well that are being considered in the military court there, is there are a bunch of men who are at Guantanamo now who were held in secret CIA custody, what we call, you know, known as the black sites, for about 4 years, most of them. And they were tortured there and held incommunicado. And then in 2006, they were brought to Guantanamo. And that's when we kind of technically, you know, we're trying to sort of try them based on evidence gathered from the point when they got to Guantanamo forward. And that is the fight. That's the essential fight, is a bunch of people saying, you know, on the defense side saying, you cannot, these men have been tortured, therefore there is no evidence really that you've gathered since then, or the evidence that you've gathered since then is all tainted by the way in which they were held and tortured in CIA custody. And the government saying, no, no, that's a distinct period that was over. And then moving forward, we can use the evidence that we have gathered since then. I'm simplifying it completely, but that is the essential thing, is like, can we prosecute these men who we tortured in CIA custody? And the answer is kind of like, not really. It's not working.
I mean, we shouldn't laugh because it's horrendous and it's such a miscarriage of justice. And also, it's just so disturbing.
It's horrible what we did to these men and the way we treated. It's also so, so horrible for the families of the people who died in that attack.
Yes.
They haven't like gone away. They are watching and waiting and agonizing. And this has now been, for them, literally more than 20 years.
Right. You know, they're in this sort of suspended animation waiting for this trial that some of them may be called to testify in, right?
Yes. But, you know, more it's, you know, people are.
They want to move on or not even move on, but they want just they want answers.
People who have like spoken out in the past, they're just like they're old, you know, and some of them are, have died before they're able to kind of anyway. So it's that part is also, I think, doesn't get talked about that much. That our treatment of those defendants has denied the families any
closure.
Yeah, I don't know if closure is the word I would use. I think that's like sort of a personal word to use. I just mean any resolution.
Yeah.
So what do you think the next season's going to be? And do you feel like this is such a different, well, it's a departure from how you've done it in the past, right?
This story?
Yeah. Well, this season.
Not really. I don't think so. I think all of our seasons have been in about ish the same thing, which is judgment and punishment of each other and what are the systems that we have to meet that out. So I actually don't think of it as very different. I think the locus of the stories is certainly different, and it is a different world, and Guantanamo is truly its own world. I mean, it's fascinating, and I didn't really get it until a little more recently, but then I started thinking about it. I was like, oh, this is really quite similar to season three, where we just spent a year and a half or so inside a felony courthouse in Cleveland, Ohio, just to say like, okay, here's how your average felony courthouse works in America. Let's see what goes on inside and how our systems are working. It's not that different, this series. It's structured kind of similarly. I mean, it's not, that one is not historical in the way that this one is, but the questions are sort of the same. It's like, how do regular people inside these systems, how do they make decisions and what are the pressures on them and how do they function inside a thing that's kind of broken?
Do you guys feel that you've learned anything about sort of criminal justice reform or any of this sort of larger law and order stuff that you think is important or relevant from your experience doing this?
I think the main takeaway for me is like we have a justice system and it's not perfect, but it works and we should rely on it and not just throw it out the window when we get scared. And that's basically what happened. You know, after 9/11, we got scared. We threw our systems out the window. We tried to rebuild something that we thought would be more amenable to our end goals. And now here we are 22 years later. And we're still caught in the muck of it all. And, you know, as you guys were talking about a minute ago, the guy who is accused of being the mastermind of 9/11 is still in pretrial hearings. That's crazy. And it happened because we just decided to circumvent our, you know, imperfect but time-tested system. So I think that's kind of my takeaway from it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, what's hard for me is that I think the criminal justice system that the normal one we have that we have on the mainland is so messed up that it's hard for me to be like, yeah, that one, use that one. But yeah. I will say Guantanamo really makes it look good. And so, like, that is true.
That's terrible. Yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, there's so many technical things that I could say about, you know, reform that I think should happen. I think in a more philosophical way, I just wish we were all had a lot more humility about things we think are true and right. I think we as a culture have just a very hard time questioning ourselves. And I don't know why that is. But that's what it all needs more of. And I think disturbingly what I see happening in this country and in a lot of, you know, so-called democracies now is less and less of that questioning. And in fact, sort of being more categorical and more sure of ourselves and our opinions than we used to be.
Thank you, Sarah and Dana.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Jill Gibson is the Chief Medical Officer for Planned Parenthood Arizona. Welcome to Fast Politics, Dr. Jill Gibson.
Thank you.
Tell us what you do and what your title is.
Yeah, my name is Jill Gibson, and I am the Chief Medical Officer at Planned Parenthood Arizona. And that means that I get to oversee all of our whole host of services, all components of sexual and reproductive health care we offer, but I specifically head up our abortion service line.
Where are we right now? Like, there's been so much drama, so much legislation, so much lack of legislation. What does the country look like right now when it comes to abortion?
It is a complete mess. It is complete chaos. It is confusion. It is panic. in Arizona. We have literally been on an emotional roller coaster since months before the Dobbs decision, since the leak of the Dobbs decision, when we were recognizing that we were needing to prepare to pause and then eventually halt abortion services, restart abortion services, halt abortion services, restart again. And then I have to say there was a period of time after we had a rightfully decided Court of Appeals decision that enabled us to safely provide abortions with still many restrictions, including a really egregious 15-week ban. But we felt comfortable. We started rebuilding. We started reinvesting. We made the decision that even though there was still the threat that this case could be heard by the Arizona Supreme Court, that our community deserved that for us to continue to work towards providing them access to abortion services. And, you know, in my heart of hearts, I just couldn't understand a world where a law from 1860s, before Arizona was a state, before women had the right to vote, I just couldn't understand a world where that could be applied into this modern society. And so I let that drive my operations. I let that lead me to continue to grow my abortion program, even though this looming threat has existed. And so we built. We got new doctors. We brought in new nurses. We started a whole entire volunteer doula program to support our patients as they're having their abortions. And even when, you know, the Arizona Supreme Court decided to hear this case, I still, in my naivete, despite having my heart broken over and over again by the government and the politicians and the legislators who think they can tell us what to do with our bodies, I still didn't think it would happen. And on Tuesday morning, the same thing happened as happened on June 24th of 2022 when the Dobbs decision was announced. I had the wind knocked out of me, and I still showed up to the exact same health center ready to take care of patients. And I still was able to provide services. Luckily, this Tuesday, we weren't able to provide services in the days immediately after the Dobbs decision. But this feels infinitely worse because in the days after the Dobbs decision, there was just a sense that we just needed to clear this up, that no one would expect that an 1864 ban would be enacted. But here they are, four justices in today's society telling us that we cannot provide abortions. And so this feels gut-wrenching in a different way.
Like, if you look at the Arizona State House, Democrats are still trying, despite the fact that politically going back to an 1860s law will probably help Democrats in the state, which is, if you think about it, like Trump, remember, Trump didn't want to pass this immigration bill because he wanted to be able to run on immigration. But Democrats in the State House are trying still to get this bill repealed, and Republicans won't let them.
I'll say two things. The first is that I still have hope, right? Because I have to have hope, right? Like, hopelessness is a luxury that we do not have when we have a need that is this acute to take care of our patients. And the second part is that this is not about politics. Like, this is real people's lives. And it is just disgusting to me to see the way politicians are now jockeying and jostling for the sole goal of using this as a means to get themselves a different position within some election. Like, there are real women who I am taking care of in my clinic as early as yesterday who are telling me that they cannot be pregnant. And these lawmakers down at the Capitol with this ridiculous, chaotic, are these stunts that they're playing? Because literally, they are jeopardizing the lives of their constituents. And how this disconnect could still exist, it is truly baffling to me. You know, I've sat with thousands of women and pregnant people as they have described to me why they need abortion. We never ask patients to justify their abortions, although the state does require that we ask them why they're seeking their abortions. And so I have been privileged to understand the real need for abortion. And we know that these bans don't decrease the number of abortions. They decrease who gets the abortions, right? People who have means, people who are privileged will still be able to travel out of state and secure their abortions. And Black and brown communities, rural communities, LGBTQ plus folks, these are the people who are already marginalized in our healthcare society. These are the folks that are at higher risk for maternal mortality because of systemic racism that exists in our healthcare system. These are the people who are going to be left behind. That's only shameful. Like, there's no other way to describe that.
I've been reading reports out of Louisiana seeing this in other red states, Texas too. It changes the way people are OBGYNs in states with bans, right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. We saw this play out in the days after the Dobbs decision when our attorney general was saying one thing, lawyers were saying something else, the governor was saying something else. We saw the real life consequences of that. I'm trained as an obstetrician gynecologist, worked delivering babies for 10 years. And I had a friend and colleague who told me that she had a patient who came in, presented to labor and delivery, who was having what we call like a precipitous delivery of a preterm and previable fetus, right? So this was a delivery that was inevitable. It was could not be stopped. And the fetus was not going to survive. And the patient was, you know, in agony in her labor and her contractions. And the standard of care is that in that circumstance, you expedite the delivery so that the pregnant person is not agonizing in labor. And the way you do that is you break the bag of water. It's an extraordinarily simple procedure. And when that happens, generally the fetus will deliver shortly thereafter. And the provider, who is a trusted colleague, who she basically felt like she could not do this simple procedure to help this person get out of agony because her actions could have been construed as breaking the law and participating in an abortion. And I mean, that's like one example. You know, I've worked in hospital systems where patients come in with their bag of water already ruptured and they're previable. This fetus is not going to survive. And we're not allowed to induce their abortion until either the fetus doesn't have a heartbeat and or the mom is so sick that then there's justification. And let me tell you that usually the justification is only when the fetus doesn't have a heartbeat anymore. Because who's going to determine how sick that pregnant woman has to be before I can induce her abortion? And so absolutely, we see this. We see this in the way patients are cared for in our emergency department when they're presenting with miscarriage, when they're presenting with abortions that have, you know, the rare few that have complications. We see the way they're treated. And we just see a hesitancy to provide these patients with dignified care.
It's a problem that we saw this coming. And it really is like the same problem that it's why they decided Roe in the first place, right? Was because the idea that doctors would need to be dictated by Republican politicians is so insane. It seems to me also that there's like anxiety about providing like a DNC for a miscarriage. I mean, can you talk a little bit about anything else you're seeing on this front?
Yeah, I think the point that you're making here is that the ripple effect of this singular decision, like it's going to impact individual lives. It's going to impact the people who are providing this care now, right? Like, how are we going to keep our healthcare clinics open so that when the ballot initiative passes and we can again have permission to not be thrown into jail for providing abortion care, that we're still in place, ready to go. But also so many additional ripples, like just the societal and the systemic and the cultural implications, what's going to happen to these people. And also one of the points that I like to talk about is the fact that if we don't provide abortions in this state, how are we going to train future doctors to know how to safely empty a uterus for whatever reason, for miscarriage management, for a DNC, for an elective abortion, for the life of the mother? There will be no one here who knows how to do that because the residents that are training right now in family medicine and obstetrics and gynecology, although they have requirements to have abortion training, if there's not the clinical practice on the ground, they will not have the skill set necessary to save people's lives. And also, who would come train here? I would never go train at a program where I couldn't get the full set of skills that I needed to be able to competently take care of my patients holistically and throughout all components of their reproductive life. This is essential healthcare. And the fact that abortion has been carved out as something unique and different is mind-boggling to me. One out of every four people of reproductive potential will have an abortion at some point in their lives. This is incredibly common. This is basic medicine. And the fact that politicians and ideology have decided that they're going to interfere and try and dictate how we control our lives and how we practice medicine. You know, I went to school for a lot of years so that I can safely take care of my patients. And the fact that someone who has no basis of understanding of any of this is dictating what I can do. Where have we gone wrong? I know how we got here. And still every day I say, how did we get here? Because when I started my career and dedicated my life to taking care of pregnant people, and then my career evolved into providing solely abortion services, I never in my heart of hearts, because I think I have an understanding, right? I have listened to my patients and I have an understanding of why abortion exists and why it's essential and why it will always be essential, regardless of what these politicians do. And in my heart of hearts, I could never go down that road because I know the ill that it's going to cause.
So nuts. One of the things in Texas, you see these abortion deserts, and more broadly, you see OBGYN deserts, right? I mean, there must be real-time information about this happening. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that, you know, there's so much discussion now, like, well, how long are you going to be able to provide abortion and how many more days? And like, the point is we weren't even meeting the need before we had a total abortion ban. And if we got to provide for another 60 days, another 100 days, it's never enough. You know, we had some choice, but we didn't actually have real access, right? And that's because we don't have enough providers. My nurse that helps me, that provided abortion services yesterday, provided sedation for abortion services yesterday, she drives an hour and a half each way. We are in Phoenix, one of the largest metropolitan cities in the country. And the nurses that I find who are so incredibly good at their jobs and so compassionate and so passionate about this work that they're willing to drive 3 hours away from their family. You know, this is not time that they're compensated. They drive 3 hours round trip to provide abortion services. And so it's absolutely true. And it's only going to get worse. Like I was talking about, those residents are not going to come train at the programs in Arizona. And then if they're not training at the programs in Arizona, they're not going to stay in Arizona. So where are the doctors going to be? Who's going to be taking care of people? I want to tell you about a couple of patients that I've been thinking about. So the state of Arizona requires that we ask patients why they're seeking an abortion. And it's part of a whole host of information that I have to report to the state after each abortion is performed, including like really personal information about patients, about how many times they've been pregnant and what the outcomes of those pregnancies were and, you know, what their ethnicity is and what their marital status is and all this information that the state is compiling for what purposes, we don't know. But one of the questions is we have to report why they're having their abortion. And I never ever ask a patient to justify their abortion. Abortion is elective. But patients so often, I think for one, because we have to pose this question, feel that they need to justify their abortion. And having sat through, you know, I provide at least 25 of these physician abortion counseling sessions before a patient has to wait then the 24 hours before they can have their abortion per clinic. And so I hear these stories 25 times a day. And, you know, I had a patient last week who told me that she walked on foot from Venezuela. She was raped multiple times along the way. She realized as she was approaching the United States that she was pregnant. And she was literally, this person was trying to make ends meet while here in this country by cooking food out of a one-room bedroom, impregnated as a result of her rape. Like, who's going to take care of that person? Why on earth are we sentencing that woman to have a forced pregnancy that was a result of assault as she walked on foot across literally all of Central America? I think I want to express to you, like, the most common reason that people tell me they're having an abortion is because they're already moms. And they have families that they love and that they're caring for.
And they can barely afford.
I had one patient tell me that she was so sick with nausea and vomiting of pregnancy, she wasn't able to work. And she was so close to losing her apartment. And if she didn't have her abortion and she missed more work, she would be homeless with her family, with her children that she loves. How are we sentencing women and pregnant people to this fate when we know from the data from the Dobbs decision what happens to them? We know that women and pregnant people in states where abortion is banned are more than three times as likely to die during pregnancy, childbirth, and after delivery. We know that they're more likely to be economically unstable, that they're more likely to stay with abusive partners, that they're more likely to be unemployed. How can we have this information and acknowledge it and still ban abortion? What is wrong with people? Shame on them. Like, what is wrong with them?
My mom, Erica Jung, was a feminist author in the 70s. And my whole life, you know, they were just so pleased that they had made it so that women weren't going to die back alley abortions. It's not just these abortions. It's the pills. It's, you know, you see Republicans, so much chatter about the dangers of birth control pills. I mean, are you shocked as a doctor? I mean, the Supreme Court is hearing a case on methotrexate, which is trying to undo the FDA approval of a drug that's been on the market for 20 years. I mean, are you shocked at sort of the unscience of this, or are you not that surprised? And can you just talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw this when Trump came into office, right? We saw that fact is no longer fact and science allegedly isn't science. And we saw a movement, I think, in our society and our culture that could get behind that idea, right? That whatever someone says can be fact, despite if it's true or not, that the truth is not truth. I think we're living in this world now that seems to be just irrational. It seems to be not, I can't understand it. I really can't. But I think that we saw this starting when we had, you know, a president who told lies and a president who said it was okay to not believe doctors and to not trust science. And, you know, our society is founded on these principles of medicine, and the practice of medicine prides itself on doing what we know based on scientific, rigorous research. There are gold standard studies that have to be performed, and they have to be peer reviewed, and they have to be published, and they have to be repeated. We as physicians have oaths to not harm our patients. And so we follow the evidence so closely to ensure that we're doing what's right for our patients. And when someone opened a different narrative, it tore open this rip in our society that has allowed us to get to this point where no matter what people with education and training and expertise are saying, if there's a louder, more boisterous voice that people want to listen to, we're being drowned out.
Thank you, Dr. Gibson.
Yeah, thank you.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Rick Wilson.
Yes, Molly Jungfast.
What is your moment of fuckery?
My moment of fuckery is Mike Johnson going down to Mar-a-Lago to Kevin McCarthy himself in front of Donald Trump. What we have seen is these guys are going to go down to Trump when they're in trouble. And McCarthy knew he was in trouble right after January 6th because he had not properly respected Donald Trump's needs, desires, and wishes. And he went down there to kiss his ass. But that was a poison pill. Once you go down there, you kick off the timer for everything Trump touches dies. And Mike Johnson has been living on a razor's edge. He's not really gained anything from going down there. He's not really gained anything. But he went down there to do this unbelievably bogus lie-a-thon about non-citizen voting. It's already illegal in all 50 states and the territories. It's already illegal in state law in every state. It doesn't happen at any detectable number, including people like Cato Institute have said, nope, non-citizens aren't voting. Yeah. But you know who is voting illegally? You know, if you want some voter fraud, go down to the Villages in Florida. Go down to Hialeah in Miami.
I'm not going.
I can give you lists of places all over America in red states where there is voter fraud in detectable numbers. But that was what they went down there to pretend was the urgent national crisis of our time. And it was a moment of pure pathetic fuckery. I will say this. It's hard to respect, you know, Mike Johnson to begin with. It's even harder when you see somebody as absurd as Mike Johnson trying to kiss ass to Donald Trump to preserve a job that he's already a dead man walking.
I think that's a really good point. Basically, Mike Johnson needs Marjorie Taylor Greene to stop saying that she's going to raise a motion to vacate and kick him out of his job. So he went down there in the hopes that Trump will tell Marjorie Taylor Greene what to do, which means that Marjorie Taylor Greene is basically the de facto Speaker of the House.
Oh, she is. I mean, that's no question.
And I'm going to use that as my moment of fuckery, too. And I'm just going to add that Kevin McCarthy had a chance on January 17th. Had he not gone down to Mar-a-Lago?
Correct.
I mean, there were like a lot of things happened that January, but had the Republicans voted to convict or Kevin McCarthy not gone down there and the Republicans had left him alone, today the Republicans would be running Nikki Haley. And Nikki Haley, I don't agree with everything she says, but she would not be trying to overthrow democracy. It would be much harder for Biden to run against Nikki Haley. And, you know, our democracy would be in a much safer place.
She would have reset a lot of the perceptions of the Republican Party among elite media, they'd say, okay, Trump's in the past, it's gone. Now, Trumpism would still be there. It would be the easiest lift for them in the world to jump to that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you'll notice Nikki Haley still hasn't endorsed Donald Trump. And for that, that is both of our moment of fuckeries.
It is indeed.
It is indeed. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.